Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here on this evening when we're focusing on what is an issue of deep concern for all of us, and I want to focus on it from a particular angle that I find is of deep concern to pro-lifers throughout the country, a question that comes up time and time again. We know that we oppose abortion. We know that we are doing everything we can to stop abortion. But what about the people in government office? When are they going to come to their senses, those who are not pro-life? When are they going to do something to protect the defenseless? When are they going to stop pretending that you can be a public servant and at the same time be pro-choice? When are they going to start changing the laws so that they protect all people instead of just some of them? In the mail, through phone calls, through personal contacts that I have, these are questions that come up constantly. And particularly as a priest, and particularly as one who heads an organization of priests, the question arises, what about the response of the church to those who claim to be followers of Jesus Christ and are in political office and nevertheless do not defend the unborn? Brothers and sisters, tonight I, for my part at least, and on behalf of Priests for Life, representing priests across the country and in every part of the country, I want to break the silence on this particular topic. I want to encourage you to break the silence. And I want to reflect on how it is that those in government office need to be challenged when it comes to the right to life, and how we ourselves can be involved in challenging them, and what we need to challenge them to do. If we're going to talk about challenging those in government to defend life, we have to start off by asking what the purpose of government is in the first place. Because you can't very well challenge someone in government office to do their job unless you have a clear idea of what that job is in the first place. And to understand the role of a government official, you have to understand the role of government. What is its purpose? When we get some answers to that, first of all from pretty far back in history, Aristotle, he said the state comes into existence that man may live. Aristotle. The state comes into existence that man may live. And we in our own country look back to this founding document, the Declaration of Independence, and what do we read there? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Words very familiar to us all, but listen to the words that follow. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, from us. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. Notice what's being said here. Because there are things being said here, brothers and sisters, that give us a game plan for addressing the situation we are in now. There are things here said hypothetically which are coming true at the present moment. And there are things here that those in the highest offices in our land seem to have forgotten, or at least to deliberately ignore. We hold these truths to be self-evident, first of all. Now, you know what self-evident means. As soon as you say it, it's obvious. Something that's self-evident is not something you have to prove. It's not something that you have to go through long arguments to convince somebody of. Self-evident means you say it, it's obvious. You know, nowadays when some people still try to claim that the baby in the womb is not human, which is a ridiculous claim, they might as well say that the earth is flat. But if they look at me and they say, prove to me that the baby in the womb is human, you know what I say to them? Prove to me that you are human. Well, that's what you might as well say. Suppose I say you're not human. Suppose I claim you're not a person. What can you do about that? Absolutely nothing. Because no matter what you say, I could say, well, why should I listen to a non-person talking to me? Right? If we want to decide that somebody's not human, friends, there's nothing they can do about it. And that is an arbitrary decision. It's a dangerous decision. It's dangerous for the person who's doing it because someone can come along and do it to them. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, all people, are created equal. Now, where does this equality come from? And the Declaration goes on to say, well, it comes from the Creator. They are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, the reason they put life first is very, very simple. There is no such thing as liberty if you're dead. You know, freedom of choice is a great thing as long as you're alive to make the choice. That's why those who support choice ought to be pro-life, because if you destroy life, guess what? You destroy choice. You destroy liberty. You destroy the pursuit of happiness. So life is first because it's foundational. We do not say that abortion is the only issue. But we do say it is the foundational issue. Because if you don't even have the right to exist, what in the world good is it going to do you to have all sorts of other rights? I give you the right to vote, the right to education, employment, and a whole litany of other rights, but I reserve for myself the right to take your life. Well, that's a lot of help, you know. It's foundational. And the reason why we defend all the other rights that people have is precisely because of the dignity of the life that they have. Why are we concerned about poverty in the first place? Well, because these people have a right to food, clothing, and shelter. Well, why do they have a right to those things? Because they have a right to live. We're concerned about unemployment? Well, of course we are. Why? Well, people have a right to make a living. Why do they have the right to make a living? Because they have a right to live. And the Declaration says that these rights are endowed by the Creator, not by the government, not by the Congress, not by the court, not by the president, not even by the Constitution, by the Creator. And that to secure these rights, it goes on, governments are instituted among men. And here's the answer to our question. What is the purpose of government? To secure the God-given rights of the people. To secure them. To protect them. To defend them, to make sure that nobody tries to take those rights away. It's the basis of civilization. It's the basis of the fact that one person can walk past another and reasonably expect to survive the experience. You know? How can the weak be defended from the strong? What is the difference between a civilization and a chaos? It's here. Governments instituted to secure these rights. Well, where does this power to secure these rights come from? From the consent of the governed. And when it comes to this situation that you and I are in, when the very same government that is supposed to secure these rights is destroying them, we must continue to declare we no longer consent. We do not consent to that. The powers of the government come from the people. We do not consent to a government that destroys its own people. And then, right away, this declaration goes on to say, there can be a situation in which the government becomes destructive of these ends, namely, the securing, the protecting of the basic right to life. The government may become destructive of those ends. Then what is the responsibility of the governed from whom that government derives its powers? To alter it. And if altering it doesn't work, then to abolish it. But our first obligation is to try to alter it, to try to correct what has gone wrong. And that's where our role comes in. Challenging those in government office to correct what has gone wrong, realizing that those in government office are exercising a power, ultimately, that comes from the government. Now, things are upside down, brothers and sisters. They're so upside down, and you may be aware that one of the justices, Justice Douglas, who voted with the majority in the Roe versus Wade opinion, who agreed that the unborn should not be included among the persons that are meant by the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, the year before Roe versus Wade was decided, he dissented from another case which had to do with recognizing the rights and the personhood of various elements of the environment. Now, in this decision, in his dissent, he wrote an eloquent paragraph in regard to the fact that we should begin to recognize and protect as persons the trees, rivers, and even the air. Oh my. The air is a person. I'm going to speak up for the air. And then a matter of months later, the unborn are not included among persons recognized by the 14th Amendment. Things are upside down, brothers and sisters. I have here a piece that was mailed to me from one of our local representatives in New York. And it's one of these questionnaires, you know, I want to represent your concerns and let me know what most of your concerns are. Let me read some of the choices here. You know what the first one is here on the list? It looks like it's going in alphabetical order, so we'll presume that's why it's first. Animal rights. It's the first one on the list here. Then it goes on child care, defense, deficit, disability, drugs, and so on and so forth. There's nothing about abortion. Nothing about the rights of the unborn. Animal rights? Oh, yes. That's right there in black and white. Nothing about the rights of the unborn. And this is one of those pro-abortion members of Congress. Big campaign about animal rights. You know, nothing wrong with, you know, coming against unjust cruelty to animals. Nothing wrong with protesting that. But somehow I think that when somebody begins to campaign for it like this, and at the same time they're not recognizing the rights of the unborn, don't you think there might be some sort of a psychological mechanism at work there? Compensating? Overcompensating? Soothing one's conscience? Oh, I have to intervene for the defenseless. I have to do something to protect the vulnerable. Yes, I think there's a good study there for some psychologists to go into at great length. What is the first responsibility of those in government? It is to recognize their place. You know, sometimes people will say to you and me, when we speak up about the right to life, especially in regard to our leaders, I said, well, the government shouldn't get involved in abortion. It's a purely private, personal decision. The government's got too involved in this. In a sense, they're right. You know when the government got too involved in abortion? In 1973. That's when it got too involved. The government got too involved as soon as it pretended to say that they were the ones to decide who lives and who dies. That's when it got too involved. Not when it restores the protection to all people, but when it took it away. That's why I don't let anybody tell you you're focusing too much on just on the unborn. We're not focusing too much. The problem is somebody came along before us and focused on that. What we're trying to do is restore the balance. You can be sure that if in 1973 the people who were deprived of the legal protection they deserved were the elderly or the handicapped, that we'd be making more noise about them than about anybody else. We're just trying to restore the balance. To recognize their place is their first responsibility. You could rephrase it by saying their first responsibility is humility. What am I here for? The declaration reflects an understanding of natural law. There is a law that is not man-made. There is a law that is higher than the laws we're going to start writing on the books or deliberating about in the halls of Congress. There is a law that is more fundamental. And to that law, all other laws must submit and conform. We have moved away from that philosophy in this nation. And one of the main dominant factors and personalities that has helped us to move away from it is the famous Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. Let me read what some of his opening words in his famous work called The Common Law. And I'll listen to this in the light of what has happened with abortion. He says, the substance of the law at any given time pretty nearly corresponds, so far as it goes, with what is then understood to be convenient. The secret root from which all the law draws all the uses of life. What is expedient for the community concerned? See where the philosophy is? What's expedient, what's going to work in this particular situation? What's most expedient for the community today is not necessarily what was most expedient yesterday or what will be tomorrow. Changes from time to time. That's why it doesn't matter that there's such a thing as a God-given right to life. That doesn't matter anymore. Everything is up for grabs. And this existence, as the Declaration mentions, of rights that are given and bestowed by the Creator does not mean, brothers and sisters, that this is simply a religious issue. It does not mean that. The mention of God is not the same thing as saying that the issue you're talking about is one of religious doctrine. Does the Bible and does the Church teach that stealing is wrong? Certainly do. It's on the lips of the Lord Himself. Now, suppose somebody in America came along and said, well, you know, those Christians, they teach that stealing is wrong. In America, we have freedom of religion. I can be whatever religion I want. I don't have to be a Christian. So therefore, the Christians believe stealing is wrong. I don't have to be a Christian. Therefore, I can steal. Does it make any sense? What is the person missing? The person is missing the fact that thou shalt not steal is more than a religious teaching. It comes from the natural law. You can't have a human community functioning from day to day unless there are certain things that everybody is sent to. One of those things is the recognition of another person's rightful possessions. Together with that, and in the same category, is the recognition of the other person's life. You can't have a society. You know, people talk about the benefits of a pluralistic society. Well, society is pluralistic in many legitimate ways. There is a very legitimate pluralism. It's good that we have a great deal of cultural diversity and diversity in different ways of living and thinking. That's great. We wouldn't want to be all the same. But if you have a pluralistic society, what you're saying is you have a society. One. What makes it one? There's got to be certain things that everybody adheres to. There's got to be certain norms by which everybody abides. Otherwise, you don't have a pluralistic society or a anything. You have a chaos. The unity disappears. We are not talking about establishing some sort of state religion when we are talking about getting back to a recognition that there is a natural law that comes from the Creator and that these rights don't come from the government. We're not talking about establishing a religion. We're talking about getting back to some common principles that not only everybody abides by, but that are beyond the realm of any government power to change. That's the only way that everyone is going to be safe in this society. When we put the protection of all people beyond the realm where anyone can come along and tamper with it anymore. That's the bottom line. That's the point. We can't just resolve this temporarily and leave it in the situation for the next generation where, okay, somebody else comes along and they can change it again. It's got to be on a firmer footing. And the firmer footing has already been laid out and recognized in our founding documents. Now, let me show you how far away we have gotten from a recognition of this. I have here an article that appeared in the New York Times on Sunday, August 6th, this past August of 95. The title of the article was Senate Limits Federal Funds for Abortion. And the focus is in on a part of the discussion that took place in the Senate about whether or not funding of abortion should be limited. Well, now listen to this. One of the senators said there's nothing in the Constitution to provide federal dollars to pay for abortions. Okay. I don't want the federal government to pay for the taking of a human life. Pretty basic. And then the debate went off into this question, well, is it the taking of a human life? So one of the senators asks, when did your life begin? He's talking to one of those who were in favor of the funding. When did your life begin if it didn't begin at conception? I think that the intellectual argument that life does not begin at conception is mind-boggling. Now, listen to what the pro-abortion senator replied. One enters prayer when one reaches this decision. You don't reach it on the floor of the Senate, he said. It may surprise the senator who just spoke to know that he is not my God. Oh my. He just threw out the window all the medical, scientific, genetic, biological information that we have painstakingly obtained over recent decades, more than decades. Just throw it out the window. One enters prayer. Sounds very nice, doesn't it? Especially to religious people. Oh, my prayer. One enters prayer when they come to this decision. This senator is not my God. You can just see the incense rising up in the Senate floor, you know, and bringing in, invoking all these religious ideas. What do you mean prayer? We're talking about life beginning at conception. What does that have to do with prayer? We're talking about a scientific reality here, a biological fact. What are we bringing in prayer for? We're not talking about anything religious here. You see what's happening, brothers and sisters? This is the idea of the pro-abortion movement. Take this whole thing and put it under the category of religious freedom. That gives them, they think, the freedom, therefore, to be pro-abortion. Oh, this is a matter of belief. Well, how far does that go? Suppose part of my religious belief is to destroy you. How far does my religious freedom go? One enters prayer when they come to this decision. Suppose I enter prayer and then come back from my room of prayer and say, you know what? I've just found out in prayer that you're not a human being. That you're not equal to the rest of us. And now I'm going to exercise my religious belief. You know? Society cannot operate this way. And no one on the floor of the Senate should be allowed to get away with a ridiculous remark like this. Nobody. And that's what we have to challenge. One of the pamphlets that I've left here tonight is called Matter of Belief or Matter of Fact. And when we talk about the beginning of human life, we are talking about a matter of fact, not of belief. You know, people have a right to their own opinions, but not to their own facts. And this is one of the challenges we need to make to those in authority. You know, this abortion issue is really puzzling when it comes to talking about government and religious leaders. Because when you see the political and government leaders talking about it, all of a sudden, it's too religious an issue for the political leaders to deal with. Talk with the religious leaders. And for so many of them, it has become too political an issue for the religious leaders to deal with. So for goodness sake, if abortion is wrong, where do you go to say it? Where do you go to talk about it? Who's going to deal with it? Not too political, nor is it too religious. It's too basic for either the political or the religious leaders not to deal with it. That's the point that we're at. Their job, government leadership, is first of all to recognize their place. Secondly, their job is to lead, not to follow. We have some leaders talking about the fact that they think they can't do anything about abortion because there isn't a consensus about it in America. You know what that's the same thing as saying? When everybody lines up and starts marching in that direction, then I'll run in the front of the line and lead them. I want there to be a consensus first, otherwise I'm not going to lead. You know what else it's saying? It's saying to the unborn, hey folks, we'd like to protect you, but not enough people anyway agree that you should be protected, so until they do, tough luck. Isn't that what it's saying to the unborn? What about their right today? What about the protection they need now? The babies that are scheduled to die tomorrow, they can't wait for a consensus. This is not an issue about which you can begin to take your time to form a consensus. Those in authority have to lead, and have to lead based on justice, not on the basis of what people might know or not realize or not want to do. That means that their job also is to change the law when it needs to be changed. One of the most lame excuses that anybody in government can offer when it comes to the so-called right to an abortion is, oh well, it's the law of the land. It is not the law of the land. There was one Supreme Court decision in 1973 which did not represent the views of the American people, which was judged for a particular case, and all of a sudden it becomes a law. What does our Constitution say about which branch of government passes and makes the laws in this country? It doesn't say the Supreme Court does. And we have a whole problem here in how the workings of our government have proceeded in recent decades, a whole problem in regard to the role of the Supreme Court and its relationship to the other two branches of our government. I would recommend a book to you called Judicial Supremacy, The Supreme Court on Trial. It's co-authored by Congressman Bob Dornan. It's an excellent book. And it asks this question. Do the decisions of the court, Supreme Court, are they the final word on what the Constitution means? And are they binding on the other two branches of the government? And he traces the origins of our nation and the thinking of the founding fathers, and he demonstrates that this is not the original intention of the founders, that any one branch of the government would be dominant over the other two, but that rather each of the three branches, legislative, judicial, and executive, would be able to interpret the Constitution in its own right, so that the decisions of the court are not final. And what the word of a particular court in a particular decision says about what's constitutional and what's not constitutional is not only not binding on the other two branches of government, it's not binding on the rest of us either. It's binding on the parties to that particular case. But this doesn't mean that if all of a sudden this decision becomes the law of the land and which can never be changed, and now we have to live with it, and oh my goodness, I have nothing I can do. It's an excuse. Something more than an excuse. When the laws no longer do what they're supposed to do, brothers and sisters, they're changing. Now, another responsibility of those in office is we have to challenge them to take up. It's to be consistent with their own convictions. And here we go with that often heard mantra. Well, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but as a public figure, there's, I have to be cognizant of the fact that I'm governing all the people, and people are deeply divided over this, so I can't bring my personal convictions to bear on this public and divisive issue. Well, excuse me, sir, but if you can't bring your personal convictions into the exercise of your public office, could you please tell me who's exercising the public office? Who's the person who's exercising the office if it isn't you? And if your convictions are your personal convictions,